Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Orpheus Chamber Orchestra is filled with superstar musicians. They rehearse and perform without conductor, and for the past 40 years, they've been leaving audiences spellbound by their incredible performances. Today, we'll find out how they do it and explore the art of deep listening with Orpheus cellist and co-artistic director Jonathan Spitz and world-renowned violin soloist Ryu Goto. Then, Carolina Film and Video Festival director Keith Barber is here. CFVF is the state's longest-running film festival, don't you know? And Keith chats it up with Eddie Garcia. He's joined by stop-motion animated film director Austin Taylor. The film fund continues behind the scenes with film scholar Mary Dalton. She's got an aisle seat just for you and her Oscar picks to share. We wrap up today's show with an interesting arts combo. Renowned composer Kenneth Frizzell and acclaimed pianist Barbara Listersink are also amazing visual artists. They share the joys, perils, and parallels of painting and music making next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. For the past 40 years, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra has been creating internationally renowned music and forcing us to rethink the idea of musical collaboration. The all-star musicians of Orpheus perform without a conductor, rehearse, and organize democratically, and along the way, they've made more than 70 albums, noted by critics for having unparalleled energy. Orpheus frequently collaborates with some of today's leading soloists, and last Wednesday's concert in Winston-Salem was no exception. It was part of the Seacrest Performance Series at Wake Forest University, and their program included Antonio Vivaldi's dynamic Four Seasons featuring violin soloist Ryu Goto. The New York City native sprang upon the scene in 1995 with his performance of the third movement of Paganini's incredibly challenging Violin Concerto No. 1. We're sampling from that live concert recording now. Ryu was 7 years old at the time, attending the Pacific Music Festival held in Sapporo, Japan. The now 25-year-old violinist sensation says back then it was all about hitting the right notes and in tune. Ryu spoke with me by phone from his home in New York.
Living life, you know, sort of having various experiences outside of what you thought was your own comfort zone. And these things, you know, not only build character as an individual, but, you know, it, of course, gives you sort of the fertilizer and for inspiration and creativity. I think that's what's changed mainly. You know, it's not that I've gotten that much better in technique or anything like that. I think the technique is, at least the standard of technique is, you know, everybody's got to have it to, you know, you have to have the tools to convey what you want to do. You know, you have to, so that you have options. You're not limited in your options when you're trying to play something or perform something. But, you know, after that, it's all about what you bring to the music. And for me, it's my unique experiences, I think, as a musician and mostly not as a musician, that, and not as a classical musician, that has brought me perspective for the music, I think.
Ryu, what sorts of influences inform your interpretation of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and what do you enjoy most performing in them? It's a real showcase for the instrument.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's not, we're not playing with, like, broke instruments or anything like that. And the Four Seasons, you know, they're, so there's an entire, you know, poem with, you know, explanations on which part corresponds to which part, et cetera, which voices and which imagery, you know.
The dog barking off in the distance during
the
dog days.
Yeah, and, but that, yes, somewhat, you know, I try to follow that somewhat. But the other idea, right, is that, you know, the Four Seasons for us is different from the Four Seasons way back when. The imagery that we associate with the Four Seasons now is just almost completely different, you know. There are only certain aspects that are consistent. But, you know, some of it is consistent. So that's the point where I decide, okay, so what kind of imagery do I want to bring into this, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of the interpretive aspect of it. You know, purely from a sort of acoustic aspect, you know, you can make it as simple as you want it or as dramatic as you want it. And that's the beauty of Vivaldi. And you know, you can make it sound very baroque, very, or even kind of take a romantic approach to it. So I like to really show, it's not exaggerated, but I like to really show what's going on in each section. So I'll take liberties, and Orpheus takes liberties. And, you know, it's okay, you can even take risks in any piece, and Vivaldi's not an exception.
What's it like playing with Orpheus? This is one of those ensembles that does not use a conductor. What's it like playing in that role as soloist, section leader, in a sense? And I guess just Orpheus in general.
Yeah, Orpheus is really probably one of, if not the most, my favorite orchestras that I play with. They're absolutely wonderful in their musicality. You know, I love the way they work, they rehearse. You know, it's very seamless, you know. It's very smooth the way they do it. It's very discussion-based, but it's very efficient and, you know, it's very focused, you know, and it's hard to have that many people do that at the same time.
It seems like it's hard to do that even in a string quartet. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, it really is. Clearly professionals, but the other great thing about it is that they're, you know, extremely high-level players from all over the U.S., and, you know, they have their contracts usually with other universities or conservatories or orchestras, and they do this as a, not recreationally, but it's a project that they embark on. So I think they bring a lot of enjoyment into it. So that's what I love about, you know, working with them, and you can feel that kind of energy even in rehearsal. And, you know, it's Vivaldi is, I mean, they played it many times. It's perfect for the sort of chamber orchestra, you know.
That's internationally acclaimed violin soloist Ryu Goto. He spoke with me by phone from his home in New York. At the end of our conversation, Ryu shared a distant recollection of having performed once before in Winston-Salem, but he suspected it was 10 to 12 years ago. It turns out it was actually 19 years ago. According to conductor, educator, and former Winston-Salem Symphony conductor Peter Perret, it was back in 1995 that the then 7-year-old Ryu Goto won first prize in the junior division of the Winston-Salem Symphony Youth Artists Competition. Ryu performed the first movement of Paganini's Impossibly Difficult Violin Concerto No. 1 and earned a performance of the piece with the orchestra during their holiday concert. Thank you, Peter Perret, for filling us in. On Wednesday, February 26, 2014, Ryu joined the world-renowned Orpheus Chamber Orchestra in Waite Chapel on the Wake Forest University campus in a performance of Antonio Vivaldi's Four Seasons. It was part of the school's Seacrest Performance Series. Also on the program was Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 and Tchaikovsky's Beautiful Serenade for Strings. I attended that performance, and I can tell you that Ryu and Orpheus absolutely rocked. Orpheus cellist Jonathan Spitz joined the group in the 1980s and has been co-artistic director there since 2008. Jonathan was kind enough to talk with me recently by phone from his home in New York moments after arriving home from an all-night flight from Japan. For you, Jonathan, what's the best part of chamber music making, performing in an ensemble like Orpheus?
I mean, Orpheus is special because, I mean, we're playing in a chamber music, you know, fashion, I mean, without a conductor and making our own decisions about the music. But the fact that we're doing it with symphonic repertoire, you know, repertoire that's associated with conductors, makes it sort of particularly inviting and intriguing for us. The real appeal is being able to really think about the music, not just as kind of a cog in a wheel, the way one can become with a conducted orchestra, but really is that we each bring our own independent musical minds to the rehearsal process, to the performance process. And the result is that there's just more kind of involvement and energy, interconnectedness among the musicians than one finds typically in an orchestra. It's a very personal, kind of gratifying approach to music.
I know Ryu was really intrigued by your all's process and decision-making and how efficient your rehearsals were. And that just kind of dumbfounded me. I'm thinking, you know, no conductor, no one person running things. How could it be more efficient? Could you flesh that out for me a little bit? How does a typical Orpheus rehearsal work collectively and sharing musical ideas?
The key to our process is that we have a lot of leaders and we rotate leadership. So each piece has a different set of principals, different concertmaster, different principal cello, et cetera, through the orchestra. So for each piece, we kind of concentrate the decision-making among that group of core players. So it isn't really a completely a free-for-all. On the other hand, if there's a musician, you know, in the ensemble who's sitting in the back who doesn't like the way things are going, they'll definitely speak up. But it's just sort of the concentration of the rehearsal sort of amongst the principals and between the principals and their sections that does give us a certain measure of efficiency. And it's just that we really were experienced, dedicated musicians who can really identify what the problems are of a given piece. We're very good and quick at solving issues, ensemble issues and musical issues both.
I was wondering how the different levels of listening and that you experience within this particular ensemble and what that can mean in terms of the performance.
That's a great question. That is really the key to the whole thing. So some of the ways in which we operate as listeners while playing in the ensemble. So if I'm playing, let's say I'm sitting third chair cello for a given piece, I'm listening intently to the rest of the section just to blend my own playing into that section. At the same time, we're all listening to the entire orchestra just to see, you know, kind of that musically things are happening the way they should, that cello section itself is fitting into the orchestra in the way it's supposed to. And then there's, when we're playing with the soloist, it's doing all of that, but listening intensely to the soloist's timing and nuance and dynamics. Some of the things that we're listening for include balancing, just that we're bringing our part out appropriately within the ensemble, you know, just Goldilocks, not too loud, not too soft, but in a way that really represents the importance of the line by how loud we play it. We're listening, of course, all the time for intonation, for playing in tune. That doesn't happen by itself. We're all the time listening to each other for in terms of nuances that we have to match our nuances, you know, just the emphasis of the music, the shape of the music, the phrasing. One of the works we're playing is the Tchaikovsky Serenade for Strings. It has such a range of tone color and kind of harmonic color. And so, you know, you're really listening that we're fulfilling the potential beauty of that piece just in terms of the sheer sound of the orchestra.
Tchaikovsky, the Serenade for Strings. How do you know within the context of this great work? I mean, this is one of the few pieces that I think Tchaikovsky himself even liked of his own. How do you know when you're getting that right, Jonathan? What do you feel? What's going on that when you know that blend is, oh, this is going to be a really meaningful performance or satisfying?
The first thing we look for and we talk about a lot on our rehearsals is the range. We really try to make sure that our soft playing is as intimate and, you know, that it has this kind of personal touch when we play soft. With Orpheus, it's always been our way that we, you know, we play big. We, you know, I think we're playing with 17 strings right now for this program, and it's easy for us to sound bigger than that. So that our work is to make sure that the softs are really not just soft, but really beautiful and, you know, that we give the full range of tonal color that way. When I'm playing a performance of the Serenade that feels right, there's a kind of ecstatic quality. It's just, it's so, so high energy and so exuberant, particularly in the outside movements. You know, that it's really, it's a great adrenaline rush to play it, and I think to listen to it.
I can imagine. Some exultant moments in another piece in the program. I guess it begins with Brandenburg 3. It seems like the perfect piece for a conductorless chamber ensemble of strings in many ways.
I mean, it really is chamber music. It's basically 10 individual parts plus harpsichord. So it's each person's playing a solo. But the way Bach interweaves those different solo voices creates these different kind of teams, like a shifting sets of teams within the piece. considered a virtuoso piece. It has a kind of lightness, and typically the way we play this piece, it has a kind of a velocity to it that I think really suits the music very well.
With regard to the Vivaldi Four Seasons, I thought it was interesting. Ryu was speaking about his biggest challenge in this piece is bringing out for him the meanings of the different seasons in his own 21st century language, and kind of based on what he sees and hears and feels about seasons today. And then I'm thinking just now how Orpheus evolves along those lines in the context of you're playing with all these different people with their own conceptions.
I mean, it's been really one of the benefits of Orpheus. I mean, very early on, we were collaborating with great soloists. And it's kind of been, how to put it, it's like from the earliest days of the group, 41 years ago, it was clearly a priority for us to collaborate with musicians whose ideas we're really interested in, and to give them the opportunity to work with an orchestra, not just through the conductor, but sort of really speaking to each of the musicians of the orchestra. So the collaboration is going across the whole stage rather than just being focused between two parties, you know, one of whom is an intermediary. I'm sounding like I'm against conductors. I'm really not. I have great admiration for the great conductors I've gotten to play under. But this, you know, when there isn't a conductor there, each of the musicians is just responsible for a bigger share. And that includes, you know, in the way that we collaborate with our soloists.
Hey, what do you think about this? I don't even know if you'd call it a movement, but I've seen several chamber ensembles ditching their music these days and getting into playing from memory, even in the context of fairly large ensembles. What's your take on that approach?
I think it's great. I think it's something that we certainly could do with certain repertoire. It's an interesting question. I mean, on the one hand, I'm going to kind of answer both sides. On the one hand, what really matters is how does the music sound? And if the musicians on stage are uncomfortable or focusing primarily on what notes are coming up. In other words, if the memory is kind of only superficial, then, you know, there's a kind of a sort of level of anxiety. And what I know, like as a soloist, if I'm performing something by memory that's not really deep in my bones, there's less nuance. So I think there's a danger of playing by memory for an orchestra that the nuances will become lessened. If the memorization is really successful and profound, then there's a kind of a freedom and an interactivity amongst the musicians that is fantastic. I think those are sort of the pros and cons. It isn't something that Orpheus has done, but we don't rule anything out, for sure.
Stay tuned. Well, Jonathan, I appreciate you taking time out, especially given your recent arrival back in the States, to talk with me.
It was great talking to you. I love your questions. I think your perspective on things is fantastic.
Orpheus Chamber Orchestra cellist and co-artistic director Jonathan Spitz. Over the past 40 years, Orpheus has made 70 acclaimed recordings, won Grammy Awards, and pushed the chamber music-making envelope forward more than just about any other ensemble in the world. Earlier this week, Orpheus played a concert in Wake Chapel on the Wake Forest University campus as part of the school's Seacrest Artist Series. Next up in the series will be acclaimed pianist Jiayin Wang and her winning combination of superb musicianship and technical brilliance on Thursday, April 10th in Brendel Recital Hall on the Wake campus. You'll find links to the complete Seacrest performance calendar at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take a short break now. Eddie Garcia is here with this preview of the Carolina Film and Video Festival, and Mary Dalton shares her Oscar picks with us next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Later on the show, we'll talk watercolors with renowned North Carolina composer Kenneth Frizzell and pastels with internationally acclaimed pianist and global leader in the field of injury preventative keyboard technique, Barbara Listersink. But first, Eddie Garcia is here with this preview of the Carolina Film and Video Festival 2014.
The 2014 Carolina Film and Video Festival, which is the state's longest-running film festival, kicked off on Wednesday, February 26th, on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. The festival runs through Saturday night and features plenty of films of the live-action and animated variety, and provides attendees with the opportunity for some one-on-one time with visiting and local filmmakers. visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for schedule and ticket info. My guests today are Austin Taylor, the director of the stop-motion animated film Death and the Robot, and Carolina Film and Video Festival director Keith Barber.
We started in 1978, and it started out as a group of students got together to show some of their works at UNCG, and it has since expanded into this wonderful event that we have now that spans 4 days.
What's the mission of the film festival, you know, beyond just showing great works?
We promote and encourage excellence among student and independent commercial film and video artists in the Carolinas by showing their works. We provide programs, workshops, and symposiums through which film and video artists can share their expertise and that they can network with each other, and also that they can connect with audiences. We think that's really important. We give filmmakers a chance to get that audience response, which is so vitally important to them as artists and their development. It also gives audiences and aspiring filmmakers a chance to be inspired by the work that they see and to find out, hey, how did you accomplish that? I mean, how did you get that shot? How did you do this incredible animation? I mean, and the wonderful thing is that you have filmmakers who come to the film festival and they are so thrilled to have that opportunity just to connect with people who love film and other animators or other experimental filmmakers and other documentary filmmakers. It seems to be a UNC School of the Arts and UNCG collaborative effort because all the films, at least in the first block, are primarily either UNCSA films or UNCG films. This is because we have developed this really nice, strong relationship with the School of the Arts, and their staff over there has been tremendous in helping us find these gems. And once again, it's a testament to the quality of the works that are coming out of that school and the type of artists that are being developed there.
To talk about some of the films, do you see notable differences? Because the Carolina Film and Video Festival, you take submissions from students and independent filmmakers and people in the commercial realm as well. Are there, you know, noticeable differences between those different arenas?
You can see some noticeable differences, and sometimes like in a film like The Last Session, which is one of our films that plays on Friday, that has a couple of name actors. It's a small film, but it's a really well-done film. It has Terry Polo, who might be best known for being Ben Stiller's wife in Meet the Parents. It has some other actors who have been in shows like Breaking Bad, and it's an LA film. So you can see that there's, in terms of the talent and in terms of, you can recognize some of these actors. And yeah, you do see in terms of production value, but in terms of storytelling, some of the best films are the most simply told films, but they're just really strong narratives, whether it's animation, experimental, or narrative or documentary. We have a documentary this year called Not Anymore that was shot in Syria during the current rebellion. A filmmaker named Matthew Van Dyke, who is a journalist and who spent some time in Syria and shot this film. When you're watching the film, an actual attack occurs as he's shooting, and we witness the attack and we watch this horrible thing unfold. And it's so powerful. Then we get local films, animations, documentaries, experimental films from North Carolina filmmakers who are incredibly talented. We get films from the Czech Republic. We have films from Germany. We have films from Australia. And out of the more than 200 submissions that we received, we had to narrow it down to about 35 films, which was really tough.
Are there other events planned around the festival on campus or in Greensboro?
Yeah, we have a special event every day. Friday, we have a very special program. An experimental filmmaker and moving image artist, David Gatton, who is a UNCG graduate, he is going to make a presentation that is going to be pretty lengthy. He's going to show some of his early 16mm film prints. We have a special projector set up for him. He is a tremendous artist. He is currently a guest lecturer and professor at Duke University. CinemaScope magazine named David one of the top 50 directors under 50 a couple of years ago. He shares that distinction along with people like Wes Anderson, David Fincher, Steven Soderbergh, and Quentin Tarantino. And he is a UNCG graduate. We're very proud of him. Yeah. And then on Saturday, we have a special program. We have two UNCG alums who are going to show their works. The first is Brett Ingram, and he is a UNCG graduate, and he is an MFA graduate. And he is going to show his film Rocketerrania, which is about Ronaldo Cooler, who is this visionary artist who worked at the North Carolina Science Museum for many, many years. And Brett and he became friends, and it's a phenomenal film. And then we're going to have Daniel Stein, who is a fairly recent graduate of UNCG, who is an actor, writer, director, and he's going to show three of his short films on Saturday night, and all proceeds are going to go to the John Lee Jellicoe Scholarship Fund, which is a fund for media studies students at UNCG.
Give listeners a basic idea of Death and the Robot.
So Death and the Robot is a story about two lonely souls who are sort of bored of their constant, meticulous existence. They each have been charged with a very monotonous lifestyle, and they're ready for something new. They're ready for a friendship. And ultimately, that's what the story is about. It's a friendship between this robot who cares for plant life. He's a nurturer robot, and Death herself. On the surface, it's a friendship story, but we also explore some deeper philosophies of what mortality really means. And we suggest several different things metaphorically that we hope that people will be able to gravitate towards.
So why'd you go stop motion with Death and the Robot? I mean, have you been inspired by people like Ray Harryhausen or some of the Tim Burton stuff?
And, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Ray Harryhausen, of course, is like the one, the man, the legend. And it's really his focus and his desire to push himself with every single animation that he does.
But yeah, stop motion animation is such a meticulous
craft. It is a very meticulous craft.
So have you always been someone that been your forte?
I see what you're getting at. Yes, I am OCD. it's strange. You don't realize when you're in it how crazy you must seem, because you really do. I mean, it does get down to the point where you're staring at a screen and you're just like, you know what, that flower needs to be moved a centimeter to the left. And so you'll take like 5 minutes to walk over and move it over and then adjust the light just a smidgen. And then you come back to your camera and you're like, you know what, that doesn't quite work. I don't like that anymore. And then you go back and you adjust it a little bit more.
Talk to me about the process of making the characters,
sure.
Of making the puppets.
Yeah, so I actually brought them here with me. I wish listeners could see them.
Oh my god, I'm gonna have to get some pictures.
Yeah, here they are. If you want to see these characters, you're just gonna have to come to Carolina Film and Video Festival. These were 3D printed, and that in itself actually was a really different process.
You'll see we'll post the trailer online to get an idea for the characters, but you know what I'm looking at is a really detailed steampunkish type of robot, and playful feminine Death. Very unique characters.
Well, that was actually a great articulation. We definitely wanted a steampunk aesthetic without going all out steampunk, so we kind of combined a steampunk with this retro sci-fi sort of appeal, especially for Robot's lab or his greenhouse. It sort of went through different phases of what we were officially calling it, but basically his man cave. And it has just all of his plants and everything in it. So we really wanted to make Robot stand out against all of the plants, and so he has a lot more of a sort of rustic feel. He's loosely based on a watering can, just to better associate him with the plants around him. He's got more moving parts than Death does, and in terms of really innovative design and just how his facial structure moves, I'm definitely more proud of how he came together. But he was also the second puppet that I worked on. Death came first, and so she was almost kind of a prototype. Because, to be honest with you, we didn't even know if this 3D printing process was going to work. Turns out it worked perfectly.
The 3D printing process, something we've all been hearing a lot about lately, you know, without explaining everything about it, could you just kind of tell us what that means?
Sure. 3D printing in this case was, normally you would use a metal ball and socket armature. We chose to 3D print because you can make just about anything and you can make it again. So that's why they call it rapid prototyping, because you can prototype like crazy.
So where'd you get access to the 3D printing?
So we actually worked with Center for Design Innovation, which is in downtown Winston-Salem. They were extremely helpful. We didn't have a 3D printer. We didn't know what a 3D printer looks like. They educated us.
What kind of budget and what kind of time frame did it take to put this film together?
Our budget actually was only $1,500, which for a film of this scale is actually extremely small. So we had to work around a lot of constraints. The sets that we made were collapsible and sort of like puzzle pieces. They could be reassembled in different ways so that if we're in an exterior location, we could redesign, we could move around like Legos to make it look like a separate part of that exterior location so that the exteriors never look the same. But we really had to pinch every penny. It was definitely an interesting process, but because it was actually a very small crew and we were all students, we didn't need the budget in terms of paying for the time that was put into it. We needed that budget, especially for the wood materials for the sets, which James Helterbridle was amazing at designing, constructing, and coming up with a way that we could really work in a small space with a small budget. It was definitely a Rubik's Cube.
really great score. Was that composed originally for the film?
Yes, that was Tom Hooser. We worked with him, you know, even starting in concept stages. And so, you know, he was really working alongside of us, building tonal tracks that we could cut into our animatics and start to really, like, collaborate together in terms of building this world and making it feel cohesive.
Austin Taylor. He's the animation whiz behind Death and the Robot, which will be screened at the Carolina Film and Video Festival at UNCG. Death and the Robot screens Friday night. The festival runs through Saturday night, March 1st. Check WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for updated film schedules and ticket details. And while you're there, you can view a trailer and behind-the-scenes footage of the making of Death and the Robot. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and for now, we're going to stick around in the darkness of the movie theater, where Wake Forest University Professor of Communication and Film Studies, Mary Dalton, takes us behind the scenes.
This year, when I look at the list of the Best Picture nominees for the Oscar, I feel kind of hopeful. A lot of years, it's just a struggle for me to figure out anything that I would vote for if I were a voting member of the Academy. But, you know, I would not put American Hustle, The Wolf of Wall Street, or Captain Phillips on that list just because of the flaws in the first two and what I found to be some degree of blandness in the third one. But there is one terrific, conventional, but still really, really good film on the list, and that's Philomena. And then on the list, there are three movies that I absolutely love. I always go with my heart and not my head, so don't consider this a prediction of what will win. But if any one of these three films wins, I'll be pretty happy. Of the films on my list, my favorites are 12 Years a Slave, Her, and Nebraska. And it is a rare year when three of my top films all get nominations. Alexander Payne's black comedy, Nebraska, is also a moving family portrait, and that's due mainly to the love that one son shows his cantankerous father on a very bizarre road trip.
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love, at least at first.
Never came up.
What moves me most about this movie is the tenderness of the son as he tries to give his aging father a shred of dignity. For me, Spike Jonze's film Her is a story that's not so much about technology. I mean, I know that's what the preview trailer suggests, but it's about the lessons we must learn, mostly about being open and authentic in order to connect deeply and enduringly with another human being.
So what was it like being married?
Well, that's hard for sure. But there's something that feels so good about sharing your life with somebody.
How do you share your life with somebody?
Well, we grew up together. And, you know, I used to read all of her writing all through her master's and PhD. And she read every word I ever wrote. We were a big influence on each other. I still find myself having conversations with her in my mind, rehashing old arguments and defending myself against something she said about me.
I think Her is a thought-provoking film, and it's just a visual feast. But if I were voting for Best Picture, my choice would be Steve McQueen's tough but true film, 12 Years a Slave. I actually saw it twice. There are so many searing scenes, but the one I always think of first centers on a piece of soap.
I went to Master Charles' plantation.
You admit it.
Yes, freely. And you know why. I got this from Mrs. Shaw. Mrs. Epps won't even grant me no soap to clean with. I stink so much I make myself gag.
12 Years a Slave is adapted from an actual slave narrative, and this film feels like the most accurate retelling of a story about slavery in the American South that I've ever seen. I've chosen which film I would vote for, but you don't have to. You can just see all three whenever you get the chance.
Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, Mary Dalton. You'll find her blog on our website, wfdd.org. I'm David Ford, and it's time to take another short break. When we return, Kenneth Frizzell and Barbara Listersink will join us for the Zen of Plein Air Painting next. So stay with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. You know, some people have all the talent. Kenneth Frizzell is a renowned composer and UNC School of the Arts composition faculty. Barbara Listersink is an internationally acclaimed pianist and Salem College director of the School of Music. But it turns out that they're extremely talented visual artists as well. Their fascinating dual exhibit at the Intersection Gallery and Art Space in Winston-Salem runs through March 29th. It's titled Seas, Skies, and Mountains and features Barbara's large-scale abstract pastel drawings of North Carolina land and seascapes and Ken's watercolor abstractions of mountain views and skies. They both stop by to share their love of visual art, the act of creating it, and the parallels they each find between painting and creating music. We'll be sampling from Ken's compositions and Barbara's live piano performances along the way. I've spoken to other artists before who are very adept at oils, acrylics, and I even mentioned the word watercolor and they just seize up. Oh, no, it's too hard, too difficult. Ken, why choose such a difficult medium for your beautiful art and the landscapes you paint?
Well, they're the images that I like to capture, such as clouds and movement. They seem the most elemental. You know, clouds are water, and you can do all kinds of wonderful, spontaneous, and unpredictable things with watercolor. You have to give up control if you're going to do them the way I do them. Now, there's some people that are very meticulous and learn a very systematic way of layering that can be, you know, they're great photorealist painters that are watercolorists. But what attracts me about them is the spontaneity, the improvisatory quality. I can escape in them. The way I do them are rather small scale. They're 9 by 12. I do them in my lap. They're very easy to clean up after. I was always getting oil paint on my mother's carpet when I was a kid and finding clever ways like shaving it off with razor blades when she wasn't home and stuff and using gasoline instead of turpentine. And she'd say, why does her house smell like gas? I don't know. But so, they can stain a tiny bit, but they're not a big problem at all. Like oil paints are a big problem. So I like the cleanliness of them. And the cleanup takes, 4 or 5 seconds. You empty the bucket, you wash the brushes underwater, and that's about it. But it's really that there's a dare involved. If you make a false move in a watercolor, there are ways to correct it, but there's pretty much no going back. And the thing that most savvy artists say about watercolor, that the big challenge is that you don't use white. White is the part of the paper that's left. So you're always having to think, I'm good at thinking negatively anyway. You're always having to think, okay, here's an apple. The shiniest part of an apple is where you have to leave the paper white. So you're having to work around these holes of white all the time. And once the paint's down, that pristine sparkle of the paper is gone. But, you get used to it, just like woodcut artists get used to thinking backwards and printmakers and all that. I don't think about it anymore. If something's white, my brush just doesn't go there. And you find your brain finds ways to work around it very intuitively. Mm-hmm. I think it's very much like jazz. It's very much like improvisation, ornamentation. And I really do it mostly to escape the meticulousness of composing.
When you say it's like jazz, I think as musician painters yourself, it's, improvisation, jazz. But could you flesh that out for me a little bit?
I think a misconception about jazz is that it's all improvised, which of course isn't true at all. It's actually all improvised on some given structure as I understand it. Of course, there's very way out jazz like Cecil Taylor or something that seems completely random. But I think the painting is related in that there might be a formal goal or a kind of motion or something I'm trying to convey in something that's very abstract, play with a certain color or something. But within that point of departure, okay, I want to do something very horizontal here. Okay, there's some colors that Barbara actually used in the show that I've been very drawn to. I'm actually looking at one of her pastels very carefully and playing with certain colors, which I've discovered are kind of prismatic things that are in the sky. So that would be the point of departure. But then within that, you wet the paper, you don't know where the paint's going to bleed. You don't know how colors are going to bleed into each other. And I'm not thinking when I'm doing it. I don't think when I compose either. I think between work sessions. So improvised in the sense of surrendering to an overall structure, but allowing for all kinds of flights of fancy that come up within that and things that you can't control. The best things to me that happen in watercolor are things that are not planned. There's certain pigments you put together that dissolve. You get these gorgeous granules the way they soak into the paper that you couldn't possibly predict or control.
Ah, the happy accident.
Exactly.
Coming back to that. And you actually drew a parallel in your synopsis, Barbara. I thought it was really interesting that between the soft pastel and performance.
Well, I think as I've gotten older, I have realized that to give up control in a certain way is not a bad thing. If you just, as they say, go with the flow, either in performance, for instance, I think, you know, I recently did a recording, and I realized that I wasn't so worried about mistakes or anything like that, that I didn't want to spend sort of brain real estate, you might say, worrying about that. I wanted to just be right there in the flow, as they say. And so when I'm painting, I've realized, just like you were saying, Ken, that random mark, that some texture will then give me a flight of fancy to follow that a little bit. But then I've also learned that if I don't like what's on the paper, it's all right. That I'll keep on keeping on, you might say, and not worry about it. I'll just see what comes out of it. That's very different from everything else I do, which is that meticulous sort of rendering of what's on somebody else's page that someone else created, a composer, and I have to recreate that in a certain way with a certain amount of freedom, you know, as an artist. For painting, I don't really care. I don't have to worry about what's coming out at all. I know my job doesn't depend on it. I don't have to worry about a critic. I'm in my little cottage out there on my farmette, you know, out looking out over Pilot Mountain, and I don't really care, frankly, if anyone likes my art. I love the fact that people connect with it, though. But I'm doing it because it's expression from the absolute center of my being. And it's like, these are like journals and reflections. It's very hard to give up some of these paintings to most of them, because they're simply symbols of that particular part of my life at the time.
Ken, I mean, you say that this idea of art freeing you or feeling freedom within the art. Can you describe that? I mean, you're out there in Virginia on the mountains looking at this beautiful, literally, I mean, the 360 landscape of the Blue Ridge, that the feeling you get and the freedom that's associated with that.
Well, I feel like I'm part of a certain kind of atmosphere, almost like I'm a part of the weather. It's not about me. I don't feel a sense of self. I feel, you know, kind of in the round, or a kind of floating quality, really, not unlike how the atmosphere there really is, which is always a little bit hazy, no matter how clear it is. Another reason to do watercolors, because you can work in these very diffuse layers and things. It's very freeing also in the sense, like Barbara was saying, I mean, my identity professionally is as a composer. I get anxious at premieres. I get anxious when I perform. I get anxious when pieces are performed that have been around for 20 years. We had an opening 3 weeks ago. To me, it was like a big party. I didn't care if I sold anything. I don't really care if somebody likes it or not. It was like a party with paintings and pastels. And I'm going to try to hold on to that feeling the next time I have a premiere and try to enjoy it more. Mm-hmm. It's really not that big a deal. They're just pieces of music that one began and worked on and finished at a certain point in your life, and you're somewhere else now, and it's like Barbara was saying, it's all a kind of fluid journal of where we are, where we've been.
I get lost when I'm painting in a way inside my brain, in a certain part of the brain, that I don't when I'm practicing usually or playing.
Could you describe it?
Oh, well, it's euphoric. I love it. But it can also be a little bit treacherous. I was doing a watercolor workshop at Assateague Chincoteague several years ago, and I got so deeply into it, I would stay up very late, couldn't stop. You lose all track, as you know. Any artist would say this. You lose complete track of time. Time, it doesn't exist. I mean, as they say, the house could burn down. You're riveted to what you're doing, which is an unbelievable focus, which I do love. But if you get too deeply into it, I remember trying to leave the house after having done about 4, 5, 6 hours straight of staring at the paper and trying to make decisions and just being in the zone. And I got in my car and I darn near killed myself a couple of times, because I envisioned as I was driving that my car was just a paintbrush And I was simply still driving along the roads, you know, and leaving this swath of color, just painting the landscape, you might say, with my car.
So this pastel painting, Barbara, Pilot Mountain, I'm looking at it now here on my little computer screen, unfortunately. But for starters, up top, the green and sky images and white combine to give this kind of ethereal, almost mirage-like view of a beautiful naturescape. And then the depth below or coming toward you with the rusts and the browns and the whites and the light greens, and it all... I can look at it vertically as if all the beauty underneath it, or coming at me. There's a lot going on there, but it's, in one sense, just beautiful combinations of colors.
That's the progenitor, by the way, that particular piece of all of this big series for a number of years of Pilot Mountain, because Pilot Mountain is that ethereal kind of, it's at the very top there. They're always embedded. Sometimes you can kind of see it if somebody's like, where's Waldo? But people will start looking at it, because these are all views from my house, actually, from my mailbox. I have the most beautiful, beautiful view of Pilot Mountain. I think one of the most stunning in the county of Forsyth County.
Oh, wonderful.
And so I have, for 20 years I've lived there, and I have absorbed the near landscape, the middle, and the far. And often early in the morning I'll come out, and Pilot Mountain, that big monadnock, which is what it is, will be floating above the mist. And I remember seeing that kind of landscape in the Alps. Ken works on the horizontal. I always work on the vertical. So I'm thinking of that kind of stacking, but I'm glad you can see some of the, read it both horizontally and vertically.
That's interesting to me, because when I think of the landscape out your window at the cabin up in Virginia, Ken, it is an amazing expanse horizontally. How has your process evolved, I mean, in capturing these escapes, or your relationship? Barbara's talking about, you know, living there with that view for, you know,
20 years.
Mm-hmm. You've been living with this view for a long time.
30 years, yeah. My partner and I have had this place for 30 years up in Virginia. And this particular watercolor that we're looking at has a very, almost a funny kind of topsy-turvy quality to it. It's a very extreme meadow above our garden. And if you are walking in certain parts of it, it's so steep that you feel like you could fall off the earth, really. So I've sort of exaggerated that kind of roly-poly aspect of it. And there's some kind of strange dark greens created by the clouds that create shadows over the meadow. But then there's kind of an electric, more of a lime or chartreuse green. To me, there's a lot of humor in that landscape with these extreme curves. And then there are just a few trees at the top that look like they might fall off too. So there's a lot of motion in that landscape. I mean, it's constantly moving. Barbara talked about the fog, and the Blue Ridge is full of clouds and mist, and it does all these optical things every 5 minutes. And, you know, it's just constantly moving. It's so much like music. There's a lot of motion in it, and progress and change and shifting and of color and light and density. And sometimes, I mean, I think Rick and I say every other day, oh my God, you got to come look at this. We've never seen anything like this before. And it's true. The sky is never the same.
That's what I love, abstract expressionism. And I know it looks sort of like a landscape, but it's like Kandinsky said, you know, when he went into abstract expressionism, that he wanted to put something familiar in it so that people could still connect in some way. And I think that's what you do, Ken. But mainly I read that as immense space. That's what I love about them. It's just endless.
I appreciate that kind of the abstract within the representational, and where how the lines blur. I think that that creates the interest.
That also, to me, has a lot to do with music. I mean, music by its very nature, a lot of people say, is abstract, and I agree with that in that it's pure sound. But then, is it just pure sound? And the more you read about particular works or particular composers, the more they talk about images or relationships or landscapes or poems or plays or tragedies or whatever. And even the most thorny, quote, abstract composers such as Schoenberg and Stravinsky and places are full of imagery. And I mean, Schoenberg is a highly emotionally charged, psychologically charged composer. And people get caught up in, oh, he's a numbers composer, he's 12-tone. Yes, it's all true. But the more we find out about these artists, the more they're making connections to, quote, real things, whether it be of a psychological or spiritual or religious or, you know, landscape references, whatever. And I think that's part of the thing that attracts me about this whole interaction between music and image, is that they are completely interwoven. And I don't really think music is tidally abstract at all.
Renowned composer and University of North Carolina School of the Arts composition faculty Kenneth Frizzell, and internationally acclaimed pianist and Salem College director of the School of Music Barbara Listersink. Their dual exhibit is Seas, Skies, and Mountains. It's on display at the Intersection Gallery and Art Space in Winston-Salem, where it will remain through March 29th. You'll find links to more information, images of their artwork, Ken's original compositions, and Barbara's recent recordings at WUFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And we'd like to hear from you. Send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. You'll find links to podcasts, archived episodes, and more on our website. And again, it's wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Once there, you can stay up to date on all the artistic goings-on in the Triad. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.